Welcome to the Dissertation Dive. This is a special podcast series where we dive into dissertations of scholars who have completed their doctoral degrees in the past several years. As you know, the dissertation is the culminating experience of a doctoral journey and includes independent scholarship that is significant to our field. So I thought it'd be a great idea to dive into some exemplary dissertations. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Shelby Eisen, the author of the dissertation titled Basic Psychological Needs, Affect and Motivation Among Elementary Students in a Physical Activity-Based Wellness Program. Dr. Eisen, thank you for joining me on the Dissertation Dive.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here. My dissertation was a huge learning experience for me, and I just wanted to start by thanking my PhD advisor and chair, Dr. Kevin Richards, and the other members of my committee, Dr. Amelia Mays Woods, Dr. Kim Graber, and Dr. Naman Khan.
Awesome. I'm fortunate. I think I've met every member of your committee, and so consider them good friends and colleagues who are well-respected in the field. So I'm glad that we kind of share that that network. For most of this interview, we'll get into your dissertation and learn about that experience. But first, will you tell us what are you up to now in your career?
Yeah, so I'm at Northern Illinois University. I'm in my second academic year as a visiting assistant professor in our physical education teacher education program. And since I'm in a visiting line that's 2 years, I'm currently on the fun process of job searching again.
I know a little bit about being a visiting professor and searching for jobs, and it's an exciting time, and I certainly hope that goes well for you. Will you talk a little bit about your background and how did you end up pursuing a doctoral degree in physical education?
Yeah, so this answer might need to be edited to be cut down if it's too long, but I'll try to be brief. My pathway to where I'm at now was very windy. I originally wanted to be a PE teacher growing up because I noticed that especially my female friends hated PE, and all they could, you know, they would think about any reason they could come up with to get out of PE. And I was just so confused. And long story short, I wanted to be a teacher so I could make a PE environment be welcoming and inclusive for everybody. And then when I got to college, I went to East Stroudsburg University in Pennsylvania, and I did my undergrad in health and physical education, and I loved it. But I also fell in love with campus recreation because I started working there as a group fitness instructor and personal trainer. And then I decided to pursue my master's at Indiana University instead of becoming a full-time teacher. So my path got a little windy, and then I went more into the fitness and wellness sector. I worked full-time in that for a few years after grad school. And, you know, what I realized was I loved leading these campus recreation training courses to teach undergrads to be group fitness instructors or personal trainers. But outside of that, my job was a lot of payroll and budget management, and I missed teaching. And I felt like the farther up that I went, the further away I got from teaching. So I had started teaching at the community college locally, decided to go back and get my PhD, actually started in the exercise psychophysiology lab with Dr. Petrozillo at U of I. And then I loved the work there because my whole thing, I guess, was I just wanted people to understand and be able to capitalize on the benefits of emotional regulation, socializing, and just personal wellness that can come from movement. And I felt like being in the psychophysiology lab was an excellent match for me there. But when I started getting into the research projects, it was so lab-based. And I actually took a class with Dr. Kevin Richards, who I know you're good friends with and went to grad school with. And his class was in qualitative research methods. And my first qualitative study was interviewing teachers across the country about stress and burnout. And I just remember after my first interview, calling Kevin and just saying, oh my gosh, I didn't know research could be this fun. Like, I get to ask people questions about their lives and, you know, try to improve things based on people's lived experiences. And long story short, I transferred into the pedagogical kinesiology lab at the University of Illinois with Kevin Richards. And that's what led me back now to physical education. So it's been a kind of winding path, but I'm excited to be back and have a little bit of a unique perspective, I think, with the programming side and how I want to implement that into curriculum. So I'm excited for what's next. And the job searching process is exciting, but a little daunting.
Sure. Wow. Everybody has a unique story. I always enjoy hearing that. And how I didn't know the specifics of your story. And it sounds so exciting that you found your doctoral focus through actually conducting qualitative interviews and enjoying that experience. And so I think that speaks to the value of integrating some of those experiences in early coursework, and glad that has worked out for you. So you had that shift, you know, you had the qualitative class, Kevin Richards becomes your advisor at Illinois. So I suppose you then got involved in, you know, the research lab there or some of the courses, and eventually you had to move toward a dissertation topic. So what were some of the things that really got you centered on a particular research focus at Illinois?
Yeah, it was actually a project with you and Dr. Richards, the 10-year JTPE review. And I, through that, I really liked the project idea because knowing that I haven't been in the physical education literature for a while, Dr. Richards thought it would be a great project for me to jump on and do the second 10-year review from your all's first 10-year review. And it really helped me get back into the literature. And what I think I learned from that the most is just a comprehensive overview of the different methods. And what really stuck out to me was intervention studies. And I think it's the programmer in me from my background in campus recreation. But I really enjoy creating interventions and then studying the effects of those. So I think the biggest thing that led me to my dissertation was I knew I wanted something that was hands-on, something that would hope to be transformational and action research oriented. So I would say that project and, you know, diving into the literature really helped expose me to different methods and give me ideas that I kind of just would run down all these rabbit holes. And I actually designed and got a IRB approved of a first dissertation that got canceled because of COVID. So the dissertation that we're talking about today is actually the second dissertation I designed. But I'm really happy with the way everything did work out because it was a great learning experience.
Wow. So dissertations canceled by COVID. I know a lot of the people in this series were impacted by COVID. And it raises the question, like, what dissertation proposals were not carried out, right, during that. So maybe that's a follow-up podcast series.
I love that idea.
So let's talk about the dissertation that you did get to do. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the overarching purpose or research questions that you looked to examine in your study?
Yeah, so the overall purpose was to understand the effects of a basic psychological needs training with program staff and how that training would impact, or if it would impact, the youth participants. I really went down this road because after studying different theories throughout my PhD, self-determination theory really stuck out to me. I think it comes down to my past experience working with people in the programming and full-time sector before coming back to academia. And just in all my experiences of working with humans, the number one thing related to physical activity is motivation. And I just really felt like the basic psychological needs theory of autonomy, competence, and relatedness really spoke to me because I thought back to the programs and the work I did with participants in the past. It really to me just made sense that, you know, if we want to get people to do a certain health behavior, for example, physical activity, they have to feel like they're in somewhat of control, but they need some structure, so autonomy. And then competence, they want to feel like they're good at it because no one really wants to do things in a social group, especially if you're not feeling competent. And then the relatedness of feeling connected within the group, that one is, to me, in education, the biggest thing. And I just really felt like there's this inexplicable link between learning and feeling related within your environment. So I just really wanted to see how the staff, again, my background was in training staff. And I just really felt like the way that I would lead trainings could make or break how the resultant behavior was just based on the motivational setup I used, whether I was supporting their like specific basic psychological needs or not. So I thought, you know, this idea seems like it could really play out well in a summer camp setting, because the literature to me at the time Didn't seem like there was a lot of information on intervention designs with staff, but I did find in the literature that one of the biggest downfalls of staff programming is our youth programming, especially over the summer, is staff turnover. And a lot of that seems to come from the stress and burnout of working some of those camps, and misbehavior can be a big part of that. And I think self-determination theory can not only be a platform, and specifically basic psychological needs mini theory, can not only be a platform to motivate people to be physically active, but I think if we get students to have buy-in in our programs, it'll save stress for the program staff. Because if students are engaged and having fun, then we naturally see a decline in behavior problems. So I went on a tangent there, and I don't really know if I answered your question, but basic psychological needs theory is what really stuck out to me, and wanting to see how I could develop an intervention that might help youth want to be more intrinsically motivated to be physically active.
Yeah. So I know there's a lot kind of out there around those topics. How did you approach the literature? Were there certain areas of focus that really served as a foundation for the research and kind of led you to the methods of your study?
Yeah, so I did a scoping review. So at the University of Illinois, we have a 3-study dissertation within our lab. So the first study can be any formal literature review, and I chose a scoping review. And then that scoping review set the groundwork for my second 2 studies. My second study was the experimental design study with the staff. And I learned so much from my scoping review about the methods of just how to run that staff training. So when I did my search, I was really looking for a couple of key things. I was looking for U.S. programs, because I know every country has their own, you know, structure to schooling. So I wanted to make sure that it was relevant to U.S. schools. I also chose summer camp programs that fell within what I called my category of wellness, which was things related to programming for nutrition, social emotional learning, physical activity, and academics. So I tried to search within those parameters, and what I found was there aren't that many programs that combine various wellness topics. Like there's a lot of physical activity programs, and there's programs that do nutrition, but a comprehensive program seemed to be something that was not as prevalent in the literature. And I would say in the literature, the one thing I wish I could do different would go back and remove my criteria for my scoping review for having it be empirical literature. I wish I would have included gray literature, because I think the reason I had a hard time finding a lot of the methods and how to lead a basic psychological needs training, or to see the specific teaching strategies that studies used, I think I would have found more if I didn't limit it to empirical literature. But I was able to reach out to some people from the studies in the scoping review and ask them if they'd be willing to share their materials. And there was some faculty who was able to do that. So I guess that would also be a little unsolicited piece of advice for future doc students, is not to be afraid to, you know, email your research, like the people you look up to when you read their articles, like not be afraid to just reach out and tell them that you liked the article and ask if they'd be able to share anything else, because I've done that a couple times and I've not gotten responses sometimes, but when I do get responses, they're very, very helpful.
I think that's a great idea. Even for, you know, those of us who are further along in our career, we always find researchers that we draw inspiration from, and that could be a networking opportunity. So you had the scoping review, sounds like it was kind of chapter one, and that leads nicely into the next couple of chapters. I suppose you had some data collection in your work. Can you talk a little bit about the methods for your research?
Yeah, so I'll skip to the methods for my study 2. Since study 1 was the scoping review, but my methods, so the design overall was experimental pretest post-test with a control group design. So I had 2 days where we did the basic psychological needs training, and the training was with a randomized selection of half of the staff of the program. And this training took place before the summer camp started. So for 8 hours total over 2 days, half of the staff went through this training with me. And this is the training I was referring to, that I was able to reach out to people that I read their studies and got inspiration from, and was able to get some guidance or an example of how other people ran their training. So in front of me, I'm looking at the date and timeline and description overview of the training, and I'm trying to think the best way to summarize it. But essentially, it was a mixture of, you know, cognitive learning, discussion, affective learning, and how it can be applied. And then at the end, they all did their own mini teaching examples and wrote mini lessons to highlight the ways they learned to incorporate autonomy, competence, and relatedness within their teaching. So that would be my study two. And then the way I collected data was focus group interviews, pre and post the basic psychological need training. And then the program itself was 3 weeks, 5 days a week, 7 to 3 p.m. was the program. And I was in a unique situation in that I worked full-time for the program while also doing my data collection. I actually wrote the curriculum for the program, which really helped because then I knew exactly what they were doing on certain days. So I was able to specifically tailor when I did my interviews and questions. For example, I wrote the physical activity curriculum, and I knew that high intensity group fitness instruction style classes like old school step aerobics and kickboxing and dance would be more higher intensity days. And then I knew we had yoga and lower intensity days. And my work with Dr. P's lab and exercise psychophysiology really informed my design of wanting to make sure that I interviewed students on days of high intensity and low intensity exercise, since, you know, the literature is very clear that not all people enjoy different intensity exercise. And especially for kids who maybe aren't used to being physically active, like a lot of the kids at our program specifically, every day, the first couple of days would just complain that their body hurt. And I think a lot of it is they're just not used to being that active all day. So I think I was happy that I learned what I did from Dr. P's lab, because collecting data at different times based on the intensity of the exercise that they just did before the interview, I think could have an impact on the results. But sorry, and I'm still not done with my methods. It was a lot. This is still just study two. But I did observations, informal interviews, and staff journal reflections throughout the 3 weeks. And then at the end of the program, did individual interviews with all of the staff. So it was all qualitative. And then, so just to summarize, focus groups, observations, informal interviews, staff journal reflections, and individual interviews at the very end. So that was study two. And then I'll go a much shorter description of study three. But study three was, so the data collection occurred concurrently because the study three was essentially studying the students. And in this case, it was K through five students' experiences in that program. So the first data collection was week one, and they were focus group interviews with a total of 60 students. And then throughout the 3 weeks, observations, informal interviews. And then they also did, I did some quantitative data collection, and at the end had qualitative open-ended questions. I didn't use the quantitative data for my dissertation. It was more of just a fun way for me to play around with practicing quantitative data collection, and then also to use the qualitative answers at the end. Something else that I think was unique about the way we collected data was there was three different doc students collecting data for their dissertations at this study or at this program, which very well could have been because of the backlog of COVID, you know, dissertations getting canceled and us all having a similar focus. So we all had different research questions, but for example, like when I did those open-ended responses every week, those were partnered up with another student who was collecting data. So I think that was kind of a strength in that I was able to coordinate and have a team members to collect the data with. So I feel like me listing off all these things sounds like it was very overwhelming, but I was very pleasantly surprised with how smooth the data collection process went. And I think it's really kudos to just the whole team involved. We all worked together really well and had very clear outlines of timelines of when things were happening.
Wow, that's really interesting. I'm not aware of a study like that. I'm sure it happens, but where there's multiple dissertations being collected at once, it feels like the stakes are very high because, you know, everyone wants to finish their degree. No one wants to be ABD, and you multiply that by three. So I can see how that can feel like a supportive environment too, where there's three of you who want to make sure that things get done the right way. And I suspect that the three of you will be in a network for the rest of your career, thanks to that experience. So speaking of data collection, you had a lot going on. It was collaborative. I know data collection is always uniquely challenging for most people. Sometimes unexpected things happen, you know, sometimes delays happen or whatever. You seem to be happy about how it went, but can you talk about what that process looked like? And did you face any particular challenges that you had to navigate?
My biggest challenge was fighting with the printer at Freer Hall on campus. I had to print probably 350 surveys times how many pages they were. And the most stressful part, as silly as it sounds, was just getting the printer to work. But once those were able to get printed, and then everything after that really did feel smooth. But again, with three of us printing and having one printer, it was in the summer and the printer room kept overheating. So the printer, after every page, would get jammed. So I would be in the printing room for like 3 hours at a time just to try to get these pages printed. So after that, everything was great. Like I said, I had an Excel document where I had a color-coded structure of which things are being, like which data was being collected on which days. I had, aside from the doc students who were collecting data, I had a research team of another doc student and an undergrad and another doc student. So there's four of us total that were on my mini team for this program. And that's, I think, why it went so smooth, is because I was, you know, I had a good relationship with all the people that were helping me prior, and they were just rock stars. If they wouldn't have been able to come on the days and help with interviews and data collection, I wouldn't have physically been able to get all of the data. So I think having a dissertation team that I trusted, that I enjoyed working with, and people that knew my neurotic ways of color coding and organizing data collection, they were very supportive rather than getting overwhelmed with everything. So we had regular meetings, and that really helped set the scene for a clear data collection. But I would say the thing that was the hardest that I didn't anticipate was data management. Because of course, you know, all the files of audio, just getting us all on the same page to save audio files in a certain way to make sure that everything's organized, participants are de-identified, all those tiny like administrative things take a lot more time than what I anticipated. So I think just time, I didn't realize how much time, just the management of all the data. And then when you have a team that's doing team data analysis, trying to figure out, okay, knowing that we have a printer that's not very reliable, what's the best way of getting everyone these transcripts to do qualitative data analysis together? And I ended up using OneNote on Microsoft so I took every article and published it, or I downloaded as every transcript, and I downloaded as a PDF, and then I uploaded it into OneNote. So that way, and then I made a folder for each of us so we could each annotate electronically, and we could each, you know, see the coding if we needed to. And that took a really long time to organize, but once it got up and running, it worked smooth.
Interesting. Okay. So I think UNCG is moving our technology system, and we're going to be on OneNote next semester. So I'm learning something. Maybe I'll share with my colleagues and students that it can
be I would love to.
That way. So data analysis, can you talk about how you went about that once you had all that data in hand. I know you had to triangulate a lot of things. What was that process like?
It was overwhelming for sure. And as someone who's a very visual learner and very tactile, I was really struggling with, you know, doing the data analysis on OneNote with my research team was great. But then once I got to, like you said, the triangulating of data and looking at all the sources of my data, and then specifically with the students, study three, because there were so many of them, and comparing the control group versus, because we essentially considered the control group to be the group of student, because, sorry, I should have mentioned this. In the summer camp, half of the staff that went through the basic psychological needs training, they only interacted with half of the students. We essentially ran two camps at the same time. So there was a nutrition station, multiple physical activity stations, and an academic station. And there was two of everything. So two teachers for every station. And one half went through the training, one half didn't. And then the students stayed with either the people who went through the training or didn't. So then kind of by association, those students in study three, if their teacher was someone who did go through the training, they were considered the control group. So then since I had, you know, upwards of 100 at times, because there was, I would say, the most number of students ever present during the program was around 80. So there's just a lot more data than with study two. So I ended up finding this free software called Qualcoder. Are you familiar with it?
I'm not, no.
So as a balling on a budget doc student who didn't want to pay for a like a service, I found Qualcoder, and it's basically, I don't really know I'm not an IT person, but it's essentially a software that's built by really smart people who just are passionate about it and keep it free. Open source is maybe the right term. Yeah. But Qualcoder is really helpful because I still coded manually. But when I coded manually, I could pick the colors. And then whenever I would highlight something in a color, it would automatically pop it into a separate document. So then I could export it all and have like very clear, almost like Venn diagrams that I made for myself to find like stark differences in data, things that might align. So overall, I would say my saving grace to study three specifically to capture all of that qualitative data was using Qualcoder.
Awesome. So I want to get to your findings, I guess, of the, you know, the two studies. What were some of the most important findings that you can share?
Yeah, so for my study two, there were three results or three themes. So this one is the one with the staff. So what I found was first, and this is might seem kind of obvious, but I wanted to first know, did the basic psychological needs training objectively have any difference in the way that I observed, the teachers reflected, or the way that they responded to interviews? And I did find dramatically that, you know, the people who went through the training had an enhanced understanding of the basic psychological needs. So my first theme was BPNT, basic psychological needs training, enhanced understanding of basic psychological needs. The biggest one that I noticed that there was confusion on is the term relatedness. The people who weren't in the basic psychological needs training thought that to make students feel related, they should connect what they're learning in one station to what they're learning in another station. So just the idea of relatedness about being about socializing and feeling like you fit in with a group just wasn't something that really stuck out as important or, you know, as important for the people who didn't go through the training. And then I also noticed with behavior management, the staff who went through the basic psychological needs training approached misbehavior more, whereas the people who didn't go through the training avoided misbehavior more. So for example, someone who went through my training, you know, really heard me say a bunch of times the importance of educating people about the why behind things, because if we want students to feel autonomous and competent, they need to know that we're just not making up random rules and telling them what to do because we want to, but that, you know, it's because we care about their safety or we care about their well-being. I found that the staff who went through my training were more likely to take the time to approach students and explain those things rather than just, you know, look away and, you know, hope that people didn't realize they saw misbehavior, or, you know, they were not as quick to call for assistance because we did have a behavior management specialist on staff. Mm-hmm. So I felt like it just seemed like approaching misbehavior was more comfortable once they kind of had this idea of, you know, what motivates youth. And then kind of connected to that theme was my last theme, which was staff exhaustion. It seemed like behavior management was the number one cause of staff exhaustion across the board, whether it was the control group or the condition group. And oh, and I just realized I said those flip-flopped backwards earlier. The condition group is the one who went through my training. I'm rusty. But the staff exhaustion, I think that the data showed that the staff that didn't go through the training were more exhausted than the ones who did. And I think it goes back to the second theme of, I think the people who went through the training just had a little more tools on their tool belt and confidence of how to talk with youth. Because the staff that we had at this program, only two of them were education majors. So the rest of them might not have had as much experience in a disciplinary, you know, fashion with youth. So that was study two. And then study three, I had three themes as well. And the first one, I'm trying to think the best way to explain this, because my study three, the one with the students, I had very specific research questions for those, and did more of a deductive analysis where I was looking for specific things related to basic psychological needs, affect, and motivation. So in a nutshell, I would say to summarize what I found is that, you know, my one theme was called BPN BOGO, like buy one, get one. Think back to the Payless shoe sales. But I felt like the data showed that if a student was able to feel autonomy, it also helped them increase their competence. Mm-hmm. So there was a six-year-old who gave the quote when they were asked, what's an example of a time you felt competent? They said, dance. I'm teaching dancing. I teach TikTok dances. So that was during an activity where, you know, a student, a teacher from the basic psychological needs training decided to use an instructional strategy of having the students be teachers. And, you know, that letting them get up front and be the teacher for that specific student, at least, also increased their competence and, you know, their willingness to want to participate. So I think the more you influence one basic psychological needs, it's like you buy one, you get one free kind of thing. And then my second theme was related to instruction and interpersonal connection. So I feel like this theme specifically was related to affect. So core affect, like that initial pleasant or unpleasant, appeared to be more influenced by instructional strategies and interpersonal relationships. So just to, you know, if we want to have students learn, going back to my original, when I was talking about my theories on learning and feeling involved in a group, I think if we want students to, you know, be more engaged in the lesson, the strategies we use are very impactful. And I think the teachers who went through the basic psychological needs training seem to have, again, just more tools in their tool belt for how to structure activities in a way that can help motivate youth. And kind of deviate from maybe the lesson plan they were given, but more able to observe and modify on the fly versus just feeling stuck to that script. When any teacher is able to reach a student emotionally, so, you know, having them have a positive valence experience in a situation, if our teaching strategy can bring that about, I think that's really important for learning and connection. So that was related to my second theme. And then my third theme was malleable motivations. And for this one, I specifically looked at the data for the different types of motivation. So along the continuum from amotivation, external regulation, identification, integration, and intrinsic. And it was just really interesting to look at the different types of motivation with student responses and observations, and just basically malleable motivations kind of speaks for itself. But I was meaning that theme as a, you know, just because we have a student that arrives at our summer camp or our classroom that is amotivated, it doesn't mean that they're going to stay amotivated. For example, the most observed way that students went from amotivation to motivation was just simply the staff member engaging in the activity with them, rather than just standing on the sideline actually playing if it was a physical activity game. I think it was really, I guess, heartwarming, and for lack of a better way to say it, to see that, you know, teachers, adults really do have a large influence on individuals' motivation just by the way that they, you know, set up their teaching and learning environment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You got really interesting results kind of spread across the dissertation. And since you were involved in different ways, you know, curriculum development, staff, research, I wondered, when you got to the end of this analysis process, was there anything about the findings that was unexpected or surprising to you?
I wish I could say, yes, there's this huge unexpected thing, but I think really the biggest surprise to me was just more in the lack, in my opinion, from when I did my scoping review, the lack of concrete data that talks about intervention dosage with outcome results. So I felt like, you know, there's so many different ways you can structure a youth program, whether it's after school, summer. And I guess the big question that I still have that I wish I would have incorporated in my dissertation somehow is looking more at the best way to structure that in terms of, you know, our program was 7 a.m. to 3 p.m., like a typical school day. Mm-hmm. And we had kindergartners, and this data collection took place at the end of COVID. So those kindergartners were never in a school before. Our summer program was the first time they were ever in a school. So, you know, looking back, we probably should have planned naps in for them in the afternoon because they were so tired. So I just wonder, you know, with timing of the day, duration of a program, you know, what's the sweet spot for engagement? You know, how many contact hours does it really take to have meaningful, lasting change? And, you know, does it matter if those contact hours are spread out, you know, 2 hours a day or 7 hours a day better? So that's something that I wish I would have figured out how to, or even thought to quantify prior. And that's something I would like to continue to look into, is just what's the best way to structure in terms of, you know, frequency and time dosage for any student intervention.
Yeah. So now that, you know, it's all done and it's signed off on and you have your degree, how has it impacted your career so far? Are you using it, disseminating it, and things like that?
Yeah, it's impacted my career a lot. I guess being still a new academic, it's exciting that, you know, our dissertation groundwork, our dissertation can really lay the groundwork for our line of research throughout our careers. And I don't know if I guess I realized at the time how much your dissertation could influence your career line in the future. So I think I'm just really thankful that I did. I feel like I bit off a lot more than I might have, you know, realistically be able to chew, and might have, as a lot of doc students do and academics, you know, burnt myself out a little bit with my dissertation because it was a lot. But if I could go back and change anything, I wouldn't, just because I feel like choosing a very difficult dissertation really set me up for success, because now data collection doesn't seem daunting. So, yeah, I wouldn't change anything. And I'm glad that I selected the line I did. And now I'm excited to keep working on that same line. But in addition to the out of school time physical activity, I'm also really passionate about high school physical education curriculum. And my first dissertation, That was the one that was canceled because of COVID. That one was specifically about revising curriculum and almost, I consider it like a campus rec model of high school physical education curriculum, where by the time students are in high school, they have different options of courses they can take, whether it's a group fitness instructor training course that's an honors academic course in high school, or that's an officiating course, because we all know youth sports are needing officials. So now I'm excited to, currently I'm working, instead of being in an extracurricular program setting, over the last year and a half, I've been working more with high school physical education curricula. But whenever I do land my forever home job, I would love to do more with extracurricular programming. But I guess I did make the decision when I started in this visiting line. I talked with my supervisor and, you know, I asked if I could start an extracurricular program here. But to me, it just didn't feel morally right to start a program when I knew I'd only be here for 2 years, because I did learn from the data that, you know, and from the experience that starting programming, and I know you know this way more than I do, but programming and collaborating with school districts is very time consuming and so much based on relationships. And I want to make sure that I'm at a position where I'm going to stay forever before I really dive into programming. But I'm very excited to work with extracurricular programs, you know, in the future and continue to work with high school curriculum.
Yeah, that's exciting. So I look forward to seeing kind of where that goes for you. And I know it'll be impactful work. So there's doctoral students out there who are listening, or maybe they're thinking about getting into doctoral study. And of course, it can be a struggle. So someone maybe is trying to figure out how to navigate that. What advice would you give someone on completing this process based on what you've experienced?
My first advice would be to like shop around for the best fit advisor. I was very lucky that it worked out the way it did for me with two great advisors. I was working full-time at Illinois State University when I started my PhD, and I would take off of work. I would use my vacation time to drive to class and then come back to work. And I was really lucky that I was able to start in Dr. P's lab. And it worked out that I was really interested in what he was studying. I had a phone call with him that went really well, and then we worked together. And then same thing with Dr. Richards, where as soon as I started working with him, you know, I didn't research my advisors prior to joining their labs. I got lucky that it worked out, but I do have a lot of friends doing their PhDs or that did their PhDs in the past, and I think the biggest cause of stress and burnout from my non-empirical data, but just from my own observations, is if you and your advisor don't see eye to eye, or you don't have similar philosophies on work-life balance, or, you know, working from home or working in person, or all of the things, that can be the biggest source of stress. So my best advice would be ask people to go for coffee and pick their brain and get to know them a little bit before deciding to, you know, apply to be in their doc program, because I do think the relationship with your advisor can really make or break your program.
Yeah, that is so true. I've heard that advice before. It's really good advice. It's doctoral advising is not a uniform model. It looks different everywhere. And so sometimes it could just be, you know, you prefer to work one way and you have an advisor who works differently, two great people, and it still could not work. Whereas of course it could be something where you do work well together, and being clear about those expectations is always going to be very helpful. So I agree with that advice and appreciate you sharing that. So this has been a great conversation. Taylor, I knew just a little bit about your work, but it was great to hear more in depth about your research. I've reached the end of my questions, but is there anything else you would want to share that maybe we didn't discuss here today?
I guess for anyone listening, if anyone is interested in collaborating on research that has to do with designing high school wellness curricula, and my big vision is to, you know, blend together wellness, physical activity, And I know a lot of states across the country, including Illinois, have physical education and health education separate. So my big focus is to continue to just learn about how those two worlds can kind of merge together and, you know, how we can use cognitive information to teach people how to be healthy, how we can use motivational theory to structure physical activity and other wellness behavior environments in the school setting that gives students tangible skills for after high school. If anyone's interested in that kind of work, I'd love to chat and just talk about, you know, what they're passionate about. And I'm always looking for other people that, you know, just are out of the box thinkers, because that's where I get excited. I know all research serves a great purpose, whether it's descriptive or transformative, but I really like doing research that tries to think outside the box and fix a problem that we see in society. So that's the current lines of work I'm working on, and I'd be happy to chat if anyone wanted to talk more about anything related to that.
That's great. I think a lot of people will be interested in that topic. So yeah, definitely look forward to maybe joining in those conversations in the future. But this has been a great conversation here today. And thank you for joining me, Dr. Eisen, on the Dissertation Dive.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.